Hello and welcome back to another episode of Sport Within the Mind podcast, where we take a deeper dive into the mental challenges faced within sport to another level.
On today's episode, we've got Professor Robert Copeland, in Chartered Sport and Exercise Psychologist and Professor of Physical Activity and Health at Sheffield Hallam University. He also is the director of the Advanced Wellbeing Research Centre, which aims to treat chronic disease by helping people move.
Today, the topic of physical activity will take centre stage, with Robert talking about his previous research experiences and how this impacts a person's mental health. So let's welcome him onto the episode. How are you doing, Robert?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Luca. Thanks for the invitation. Looking forward to the conversation today.
Brilliant. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about straight away your role as a psychologist. I saw from your on the Sheffield website your profile said you were a psychologist within the professional sporting industry. Could you kind of touch up about that?
I'm an academic at Sheffield Hallam University. I've been here for 20 years or so, and over that period, I've worked with a whole range of different population groups, including elite sport. And my training is as a sport and exercise psychologist with the British Psychological Society, and they hold the kind of the handle on overseeing sport and exercise psychology in the UK. It's a protected term now with the Health and Care Professions Council, and in order to be a sport and exercise psychologist with the BPS, you need to be registered with what we call the HCPC. So yeah, I've worked with a whole range of sports for a number of years, but most of my time now is spent with clinical populations, looking at population health and trying to promote physical activity.
How does for people that maybe don't know kind of the role of a sports psychologist within, let's say, professional sport, how does that kind of differ from a therapist or for an athlete or maybe a player carer?
Yeah, so sport and exercise psychologists, we typically focus on performance related outcomes, and there's various ways to achieve that, including working with athlete health and wellbeing, but our focus is around performance outcomes, and that can be either with the individual or it can be with the team culture. So it's not, our work is not always one-to-one with an athlete. In fact it's often rarely one-to-one with an athlete. We do quite a lot of work with coaches and organizations, and we also have very clear boundaries when it comes to things like what we would describe as psychological morbidity. So if an athlete, for example, is exhibiting a clinical issue related to their mental health, we would refer them onto a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist or appropriate support that is within a clinical setting. So we have very clear boundaries about where we might or might not work.
What type of methods do you use or have you used in the past?
There's often a perception that, you know, a sports psychologist is there working one-to-one with the athlete, whereas actually so much of our role is about creating the right environment for an athlete to thrive. So, for example, we might work with a coach or an organization to create pressure situations within a training environment to prepare an athlete for a competition. For example, we might introduce stress into the training environment. That could be a physiological stress where we maybe ask an athlete to, repeated sprint efforts before performing a particular skill. So we increase the heart rate, we put them in a state of physiological stress, and then we might ask them to perform a particular skill where they therefore need to control their heart rate, control their breathing. Or it might be we create a psychological skill in that we put performance boundaries on where there is a consequence to failing at an activity. So we may introduce things like social comparison, where we get others to rank themselves based on their performance with their peers. And then we might create leaderboards. And the whole idea is we're trying to introduce pressure into the training environment. So there's lots of different tools and techniques that we use to support athletes and coaches.
Yeah, it sounds like preparing themselves kind of like as a professional environment in a training ground. So then when it comes to the actual thing, they can kind of be at their best, basically. I've also seen that you're the director of National Center for Sport and Exercise Medicine. It was the Olympic Legacy Program in 2012. Could you kind of touch on that? Sounds quite interesting.
Yeah, so I've just for accuracy, so I now have handed that program over to a colleague, but I set up the National Center for Sport and Exercise Medicine with colleagues in Sheffield on the back of the London 2012 Olympic Games. And London was awarded with a promise to inspire a generation and use the Olympic Games to increase the health and well-being of the population. One of the things that they said they would do, the people that organized the Games Legacy said, we will establish a national center for sport and exercise medicine. And that would do two things. It would train sport and exercise medicine doctors to improve their work with athletes. And it would also bring together academics and clinicians and various sectors to look at how we can make it easier for people to be physically active. And so in Sheffield and in the East Midlands and in London, we bid to be partners in this National Centre for Sport and Exercise Medicine. So we were awarded with £10 million from the government to set up our National Centre. And in Sheffield, we used that money to create three facilities that co-located NHS clinics in leisure centres, with the whole idea of making exercise a core part of treatment for people with a whole range of different conditions. The banner that we used for that work was called Move More, and the Move More program is still going in Sheffield. What are we now, over a decade later?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound brilliant.
There actually isn't any evidence that hosting an Olympic Games actually makes sees an increase in physical activity.
Oh, really?
If you look, this is one of the challenges that we've worked through is that what it does do is create an opportunity, what we call the kind of festival effect, to engage people in a conversation about physical activity. But just by hosting the games, there has been no evidence that that actually makes a difference at a population level at all. So it increases or has the potential to improve facilities. It has the potential to improve infrastructure and to get more people interested in sport. But the evidence tells us actually what tends to happen is that people that are already interested in sport do more of it, or maybe try new sports, but that the people who are actually physically inactive, it doesn't make very much difference at all. So
there's no
the game,
really.
No, there's no behavior change. And the reason for that is because actually the Olympics by themselves has no mechanism to engage people. You have to create pathways. You have to leverage what we call leveraging the effect of the Olympics.
When you were on about the Olympic Legacy Program, I know it said that with the NHS, you're kind of going for a kind of a school approach to increase physical activity. What was the goal?
Yeah.
What happened there?
Yeah. So that was really connected to this idea around inspiring a generation. So we recognized the opportunity of the Olympics, and we, through the Move More program, we worked with a number of schools to try and introduce further opportunities for physical activity. And actually, we combined technology in with it. So we used a technology called RFID tag. So if you go to a hotel and you get your key card and you press your key card and it lets you in your hotel room, that's a form of RFID tag. And we used these tags. We gave kids wristbands with these RFID tags in. And we put sensors around playgrounds. And when the kids were in play or during their lessons, we got them to run around and tag. And the number of tags that they could collect, we then translated that into points into the classroom. And then the kids would use these points to do math problems. They'd do science problems. They'd even do geography problems to say, okay, if the distance between one tag and another tag was this one, how many tags would you need to do to move between here and in Sydney, or here in Athens, or here to London to be part of the Olympics? And so it's starting to introduce movement into the curriculum in a different way. This wasn't a PE lesson. This wasn't a sport focus. This was about introducing movement into everyday life as part of school. And things like the Daily Mile, which you may have heard of, which is where kids try and run a mile every day of their school life to introduce physical activity, is another way of embedding movement as part of the natural school day. So rather than restricting it to a PE lesson, we were thinking about how can we create a more active school day. So that's some of the things that we did.
When you kind of give them an activity to do, they're kind of actually not thinking about what they're doing. How much can you do without actually realizing you're doing it?
Exactly. And that is really based on the, you know, kind of the defaults that most of our behavior is automatic and habitual. So we've got to make the defaults the active choice. And this is partly where things like, you know, building the right infrastructure to encourage and prioritize cycling and walking. So if you want to change behavior, you've got to do two things. One, you've got to create a really strong incentive, but then you've also got to create a really strong disincentive to remove that behavior. It's no good, you know, just building cycle lanes, because if the infrastructure around driving is still really good, people will choose driving because it's cognitively and psychologically and physically easiest. Whereas actually, if you make it slower, more expensive, and actually you increase the friction around driving behavior, and at the same time you make cycling, walking, public transport much easier, cheap and faster, people will switch.
Yeah.
So you've got to create those incentives and also those disincentives at the same time.
I've seen that the NHS noted that technology is actually the reason for people being less active. However, I think I saw that one of your researches, you found that technology supports an increase in physical activity.
In some circumstances, the introduction of technology can be really, really helpful in encouraging and maintaining physical activity. Particularly the maintenance side, what technology is really helpful for is self-monitoring. And if we think about some of the behavior change techniques or the psychological techniques that are really powerful in supporting people to engage and remain physically active, we know self-monitoring alongside things like goal setting and social support are really, really powerful techniques. And so if you've got a watch that tells you how many steps you've done and you've set a goal to achieve, like, for argument's sake, say 10,000 steps, they can be really powerful motivators, particularly if you then start to work with others and build in that social support. Technology in and of itself, though, isn't going to solve the inactivity problem. In fact, you identify there that in lots of scenarios, technology has actually reduced the amount that we need to move.
With the impact of technology, there's maybe a sense of loneliness in a way, and there's obviously a lot of research to show that social groups are the helps getting involved with physical activity, and maybe having technology makes us kind of more lazy in a sense.
You know, there are downsides, you know, the growth and development of esports, as that's become more professional.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that professional esports players have recognized they spend huge amounts of time being sedentary. But they also recognize that actually the fitter they are, the more active they are, the better they're able to perform because of their the cognitive and physiological response that you get by being fitter. It means you're more alert, means, you know, you're able to perform better in esports.
Video games.
Exactly, all that sort of stuff. What we found in some of our research, particularly with people, some of the work we've done, people with a cancer diagnosis, is that things like Facebook groups, WhatsApp groups, can be really powerful tools to create a sense of social support. We've also found that things like chatbots and talking therapies using apps can be really good for engaging teenagers and adolescents who have perhaps anxiety-related issues, to engage them in support and therapy. So technology can be really, really powerful.
Yeah, that is definitely something that can really bring people together. The only thing I'm a bit interested about is maybe a different age group. So maybe children growing up, how are they meant to then get involved with physical activity? They've kind of in a generation now where they're brought up and it's just technology's everywhere. So is there a slip in physical activity?
Well, we're certainly seeing, if you look at the data around children's physical activity, the data is declining, but children are becoming less physically active. It's no different really for adults, to be perfectly honest, we've at a population level. But the key thing to focus on is that there are inequalities within that. And we tend to see that the poorer parts of society are less active, and that's really where we need to start to focus. For me, I think the opportunity of technology to engage and to connect with young people, we have to harness that. We can't ignore it. But at the same time, we have to look at opportunities to create physical, what we call physical literacy. So the ability for kids to be able to run, jump, catch, throw, basic movement skills that are fundamental to so many parts of us remaining and being active. And that starts at school. That starts with really good school-based curricula to teach the kids the fundamental movement skills that then give them confidence to be able to engage in sport.
Kind of onto that same topic, I've seen a research that you did, and it was from the Shoe Profile. It was optimizing the benefit of a football for mental health.
Yeah, so what? So this was a project that we did with Sheffield United, and they have part of their community foundation. They have a walking football program,
Okay.
and so what we were really interested in is what might the mechanisms be, or how might we start to support more people to be physically active, particularly men, with a health condition. And we found that the introduction into something that they connected to emotionally, like football, and by introducing an activity that was not hugely intense in terms of their physical activity, but was social, something like walking football, was incredibly powerful at engaging that population in physical activity. It reminded them of their youth, so they were able to share stories of real significance with one another. It created a community cohesion, so they had relationships and built a social support network. And it was also more interesting to them than just going out for a walk. So this idea of walking football and the kind of number of mechanisms that intervention created for being and sustaining physical activity was actually really powerful. And there's a whole network now across the UK of walking football groups for a whole range of different conditions, including people with a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear about just how walking football can. I know for someone like me, well, obviously right now I wouldn't enjoy that. I'm quite competitive. I need to be running about, and if I'm playing football, anything like that. But it obviously for maybe an older, I'm guessing it's an older category age group where maybe physical activity is actually limited, and yeah, they can't do as much.
Yeah, and certainly for or if people have been out or disengaged with physical activity for a long period of time, it can actually be quite intimidating to re-engage with that because of the perception that I might need to perform. Am I going to be good enough? Are people going to judge me? Are they going to think I'm rubbish? And if you've got a perhaps a mental health condition where your perceive your self-efficacy, how you perceive yourself is really low. Engaging in these types of activities can be really fearful, and therefore people don't engage.
Yeah, I mean, talking about that fearful factor of someone, I think one of the topics is injuries. I mean, what would you advise to someone who's maybe has a long-term injury, and what kind of things could they maybe do? Maybe someone my age, maybe someone around the 20s, 30s, someone who can do regular physical activity but with an injury may struggle.
Yeah, I mean that's a difficult question in the sense of it really depends on what the injury is. And so we, for example, musculoskeletal injuries, so back, knees, hips, joints, joint related stuff. We found that lots of water-based activity in our research can be really helpful. So
Okay.
there's quite a lot of swim-based programs, even strength and conditioning-based programs that use water to support your body weight. Can be a really good way of re-engaging in physical activity.
Is there any other kind of like mental health, mental implications of physical activity or taking part in sport? Is there any other research you've done and you've thought, wow, that's shocked me?
the value of being active for people's confidence outside of a sporting context. So what we've found is that within a work environment, physical activity is a really powerful mediator of stress. We did some work with the police force down in South Wales, and we created a series of games that connected police officers together, so walking challenges and step-based challenges. And we found that actually it was it's a very stressful environment, the police, particularly around some of the call centres. They were very sedentary, and we found it was incredibly effective at mediating the effects of stress and helping people to cope. I don't think that's often recognised as much as through the sort of general stresses of life and the ability, you know, if you can remain active, you are much more resilient. And then the other thing as well is that physical activity can be an indirect benefit to a whole range of different things. So, for example, we did some research looking at the role of connecting people to employment. So people who are out of work, taking them on walks to be able to practice interviews, be able to develop CVs, and be able to use the mechanism of walking with one another's and group-based walks to get them used to interacting with people again, to therefore get them more employable. So, you know, the purpose wasn't actually about physical activity. The purpose was to support people back into employment. But physical activity was a way to do that, enable people. So it's often physical activity by stealth, really. We're trying to find ways that the focus isn't about being active, but you can introduce physical activity into lots of different contexts to get an additional benefit from the activity that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I think I kind of get what you're saying there. It's kind of like an escape, especially when you're maybe in a job that you maybe don't enjoy or anything like that. It's kind of like an escape from maybe your everyday lifestyle. So,
yeah, particularly if you're outdoors, you know, if we know that being connected to nature makes a big difference to people's ability to cope and to get that sense of perspective, which is also really important, being able to deal with stress.
Thing I was going to talk about as well is your work, your psychological work with Macmillan.
Yes. Yeah. The Advanced Wellbeing Research Centre, we have one of our core strategic areas of work is around cancer, and particularly supporting people with a cancer diagnosis to prepare for and recover from treatment. That work is funded by Yorkshire Cancer Research, and we've done a lot of work. In fact, we now had over 1,000 patients through our what we call our Active Together service. You can have a look online under Active Together Sheffield. And we've designed a service that supports people with physical activity, nutritional support, and psychological support to get ready for their cancer surgery or their chemotherapy, and then to support them afterwards when they come out of surgery to recover from their treatment. And the work that we've done in Sheffield, we've now expanded to South Yorkshire, but we're involved with an international group with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and also Macmillan to design and develop international guidance around what we call prehabilitation, so the period before treatment, to support people with a cancer diagnosis to be best prepared they can. And the reason that's important is because the evidence tells us that the fitter you are prior to your cancer treatment, the more psychologically resilient you are prior to your cancer treatment, the better your outcomes post-treatment. So you can do a lot of work to support people in that pre-intervention period.
I think, yeah, that's something really interesting, because that is quite a common thing. I think when people kind of receive that news, or especially with cancer, it's like one in two. And yeah, I think when something like that can help it, or physical activity can help it, that is such a huge thing. Like, yeah, and it can help.
And the other thing is that it gives people a sense of control. So they feel like they are in control of some part of the treatment. Whereas for the rest of it, cancer just typically happens to you.
Yeah.
Whereas being, and so does the treatment to a certain extent, whereas being physically active and preparing well for for treatment feel it gives you patients tell us it gives them a sense of control over what's happening, and that's really quite powerful.
The last thing I'm going to ask you is, what are your goals over the next couple of years for like improving physical activity, if it's in sport or just in physical activity in general?
So over the next couple of years, through the Advanced Wellbeing Research Centre, our strategy focuses on five global challenges. And very briefly, they're about how can we develop lifelong physical activity for people in the population? How can we tackle inequalities? That's really, really important to us, because we know that there are people in the society who have the least, who we need to be able to create better conditions for. Closing the skills gap. So how can we train and educate people to work with people more effectively to be physically active? What's the impact of climate change, and how can physical activity make a contribution to that? And then finally, and it's connected to the cancer work, we're really interested in reimagining what the rehabilitation pathway might look like for people with long-term conditions, and how can physical activity and exercise and technology play a role in improving outcomes for those people. So that's what we're going to be focused on.
Brilliant. Sounds like you've got a lot on the table.
Yeah, for sure.
Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no worries. No worries. All the best really with it, mate. No, it's my pleasure, Luca. Thank you.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. We've learned that from an educational and research standpoint, the impact of motivational drivers of physical activity, technology to increase participation, the mental gain of taking part in physical activity, and how a person's lifestyle's inequalities can affect their involvement in sport. Thanks for listening to the Sport Within the Mind podcast. On the next episode, we will be talking about the mental challenges female athletes face. To discuss this topic, I will have the pleasure of hosting current Irish heptathlete Anna McCauley. Be sure to check out the episodes on Captivate FM for any episodes you may have missed. But until then, it's bye for now.